Anyways, we're going to talk about, in a way, of how to deal with the critical self. You know, there's this voice in us that actually our society cultivates a lot. You know, I even think of modern education. They want to develop the critical faculty. You know, I can even remember in academia, being critical was like, wow, that's what you wanted to be. If you could put down something better than somebody else, that was kind of considered good. That was insightful. And there is insight in saying things. But on the other hand, in a way, we've made a monster. And our culture has made sort of a monster out of something that is actually kind of an inward tyrant that criticizes. You know, it's almost like somebody on the shoulder saying, you're no good type of attitude of mind that's often in our culture and in most of us to some extent or other. I can even remember something good will happen to me and I'll almost have something saying, you don't deserve a kid, right? Plus it's going to go away and you'll suffer again. And part of training is based on the fact that when we practice, we're in touch with something that's very positive, that actually embraces what's going on. And it's actually necessary, like, for practice to kind of care about what you're doing and have passion for it, you know, passion for the training, passion for, wow, the path and what's going on. And that actually, the positive attitude of mind to what's going on is really very critical. It's like when you encounter difficulties, which is part of life, both inward and outward difficulties. Inward difficulties, like you're stuck with something. Outward difficulties, you're stuck with someone else. You know, dealing with, whether it's whoever it is. And if you get the intent right, there's something positive going on with whatever is unfolding. And then you can take care of the difficulty, but it feels good. It feels positive. And the way, it's almost like you can, if you're helping somebody and you know that it's a good thing to help them, the difficulties, just think of taking care of somebody who is ill, sick, or really needs help. You don't feel like, wow, this is so difficult. Often you feel like, but it may be difficult, but you also feel, wow, this is positive. Because the intention is underlying it, which is, this is what's needed. This is good to do. And it's not a problem, the fact that I'm having to get up and miss some sleep or, not rest when I want to rest. I can even remember, you know, just, you know, being, you know, that'll come up, being in the situation where I'm about ready to, you know, kind of end my day and something comes up and suddenly I'm working for, you know, and I have to kind of, but if it's a good thing to do, then the difficulty isn't a problem. And when our intention is right, even the difficulties we encounter are okay. And when our intention is wrong, everything is just getting in the way of us. And you can actually see it. Just think of when you do anything. With the right intention, it's not that much of a problem. With the wrong intention, which is, what I really want to be doing is this, but I have to be doing that. Then it's like, oh. When you're kind of carrying this weight around. And that's why in a lot of Buddhist training, to get the right intention is key. Because there's something freeing about kind of knowing you're doing what is needed to be done, which makes it simple. You know, it's like, oh, you know, think of it. Sometimes it's something really hard, but when you know it really needs to be done, you don't even question it. It's not like, why am I doing this? God, I have to be doing this, when it's kind of clear. You know, it's almost like at times when I've had to do physical therapy, and it was hard. But it was kind of clear, well, if I ever want to be whole again, I better do this. And it's not like, I was, you know, with, when you see the consequences, the motivation is there. And when your intention is right, you actually want to do the good thing. And that's why the intention with training is important, because the intention is, how do we approach what goes on in life? How do we approach what we're encountering? And part of it is realizing that when we're just trying with the wrong intention, we're actually putting a lot of our energy into just not accepting what's going on or grasping after what's going on. And that's where the energy is going to. And all you have to do is look at your life to realize this is what's going on a lot of the time. You're just getting caught up in something, and then the other things are getting in the way, or you're trying to avoid something. You know, even kind of look at my newsletter. And I was thinking, huh, I have to get this done, or else nobody's going to know what the future of the priory is. It's like, unless I come up with a calendar, we don't have a calendar. And I have to let people know if I really want them to follow it. And part of it is that why I'm talking about our intention is we have to get in touch with our good intention, our good heart, because that's what frees us of the critical mind, is seeing the intention. Well, when you're just caught up in grasping and pushing away, there isn't a good intention. And then you get overly wrapped up in the consequences of what happens. God, I'm awful. Or, wow, I'm such a wonderful person. Whichever one it is. And more often than not, being in a critical frame of mind, which most of our culture is produced, which actually isn't the same in every other culture. Our culture is one that this is part of our culture, to be self-critical. I remember one monk was teaching somebody who grew up in a different culture, you see, and the person just wasn't that critical of himself, and he found it, wow, it's unique. I mean, he grew up, I mean, there's other problems, you know, there's other karma, and there was actually a karma of complacency in that case. You know, it's like he would make a mistake and it was no big deal. I even heard, like, one way a delusion helps Westerners with Buddhism is, since they're so desperate and the only thing that means is what's means anything to them is what's happening right now and this life and all the rest. Well, they'll say, you'll meet a Buddhist monk, and they'll figure, actually, I'm making some good karma just being a Buddhist monk. In this lifetime, that's kind of like enough. Well, an American would usually kind of go, no, I have to be enlightened, you know, and doesn't kind of just think, oh, in this total scheme of things, you know, I'm doing something meritorious. I don't really have to struggle as much. Well, Americans actually don't have that. Usually Westerners don't have that point of view, so they have much more of a desperate thing, and that's also why they often burn out, because desperation only takes you, isn't the right intention. You're not going to get, you know, you can't desperately train indefinitely. It just doesn't work. It can work for a while, but it doesn't, in the end, you have to just realize the right intention is enough. Just plug away at it and just try to purify your intention. And when we get out of in touch with the right intention in training, of how to embrace all of this without grasping and pushing away, how to see the Buddha in whatever we're doing, you know, it's very easy to get confused. But there's no confusion if you know what you're trying to do, which is actually, doesn't, the external isn't that big. What you're trying to do is get your heart in the right place, which actually isn't that confusing when you look at it. But it is confusing when you actually get caught up in, should I have this? Shouldn't I have this? You know, and all these other questions that actually you know, and when you get lost in the intention, you just get lost in kind of different narratives, like, oh, I'm this type of person, I'm that type of person. You know, it's like somebody coming up to me and telling me what, you know, they're not a good meditator. So I said, okay, when your mind wanders, bring it back. And remember, that's all you need to do. It's not like this, wow. You know, it's like walking up a hill and saying, wow, I'm finding this tiring. You know, just walk. You know, if the best you can do is slow, you're still going up the mountain. Just like if the best you can do is have some difficulty bringing yourself back, you're still going up the mountain. You know, it's not like you have to be, wow, it's only worth doing if I can do it. And that's often, the critical mind. This is only worth doing if I can do it really well. Like, whatever that means. And you look at somebody else and they look like they're doing really well. But of course, that's because they're sitting still, looking at a wall.
Probably asleep.
At that very moment.
You know, and you don't know what, you know, they could be sitting there looking, thinking, you know. I mean, I've had it where people told me how envious they were at times. I remember one time, like, I felt completely awful and somebody was with me saying, you're always so happy. I was particularly feeling awful at that moment. I'm thinking, here they are envying my happiness. I feel like life is crushing me because something had just gone wrong at that very moment in a dramatic way, and I was feeling awful. But person even kind of has a picture of us at that moment, because and kind of says, we were all so happy then. And I looked at the picture and I did look happy. Had a big smile on my face and all the rest, because there was something positive too. It wasn't just straight suffering. So and when we get stuck, and that's why we want to, in training, a lot of it is bringing it back to that intention. What are you trying to do? Unless you're trying to do good, yes. But that is, training in a way is getting ourselves in harmony with the fact and getting in touch with the fact that we want to do good. And the question is, what do we do when we don't do good? Because even if you want to have the right intention, I mean, I have all sorts of intentions. Hell, I sit down to meditate intending just to be still, and I have trouble after all these years always being still when I meditate. You know, I'll suddenly realize, God, I'm right in my class. Or suddenly I hear myself getting caught up in complaining or feeling like, you know, or just sometimes just not wanting to be where I am, which can come up. And the intention isn't in our head, it's in our hearts, in the sense that it's not like what you understand. What, you know, just like if you're with somebody, just are you trying to do good? You know, even if you blow it, you still, you know, it's like often like a mother can look and say, I was trying to help my kid. You know, you look back and you realize, God, I made a mess of something. But you can actually, you know, if you look at the intention, and actually one of the things that allows the kid often to, you know, in the end let go of it is often the kid knows the parent's intention was good, even though they were caught up in worry or fear or opinionation, like it's the end of the world if you get a tattoo, which I'm sure some parents are kind of thinking, you know, nowadays, or a piercing or something, and, you know, you kind of go, it's not going to make much difference in the long run. If they don't do it on their forehead, they can cover it up. And it's plus the whole world soon's going to be full of people with tattoos, and it will be like, oh well. And it's even why when we lose sight of our intention, we can get caught up with ideals of how things should be and how we should be. And then it's very easy to get upset, like, how could I be this way? And the trouble with that is often then we don't even want to see what's going on because it's unacceptable how we are. And there'll be people who are, you know, that actually is a common problem, is that you don't even want to look at something because you shouldn't be that way. So let me not think about this because it's just too awful what I did, what I thought. And that's an awful way of being, you know. If you get in touch with your good heart, the real intention, you realize even when you make a mistake, it's not really what you wanted to do. You got caught up in something, overwhelmed by karma. It's like a good example of what everybody does at times is getting angry or frustrated. And often we know intellectually, you know, it's not unusual. We know we shouldn't be getting upset about this, but the karma comes up and, you know, it's like somebody, it's like I've had situations where I come in to talk to, you know, I'm going to go with somebody who gets on my nerves, and I kind of tell myself, I'm not going to let them bother me, and they bother, and I react, and I kind of think, okay, but that really wasn't my intention, and I realize there's some deep karma there, you know, and in fact, I even noticed, you know, and the way it kind of, you know, most noticeably came up in my case was with my mother. Very nice woman, but God, she could push, you know, it's like, it was like just hitting an old button that I hadn't dealt with. Like, this is Kinray being upset, or my non-Buddhist karma that I grew up with. She's touching it. This annoys me. You know? And suddenly I'm back there and I'm being annoyed just like I spent a lifetime of kind of saying, oh God, I don't want to be around that. And that's why even taking the three refuges, not even, the way taking the three refuges is a way to recollect ourselves and put ourselves, see our intention. I take refuge in the Buddha, refuge in what's real, taking refuge in the Dharma. There's a teaching. And actually, whatever we're encountering is the Dharma. There's a teaching there. How are we reacting to it? You know, there's teaching, there's karma, there's intention. You know, I take refuge in the Sangha. You know, what's the teaching I've been given? What's the example I've been given? And while our critical mind is often full of ideological positions, like hard-set things, like this is wrong, this is unacceptable, this is the way things should be, this is the way people should be. Think of how easy it is to, I mean, people will say, if you listen to one and hear delusion, just listen to what you say sometimes, like, how could they be that way? You know, how could they not notice this, or how could they be so, whatever it is, selfish, proud? And you're losing touch with empathy. It's the wrong intention. You know, you're allowing a critical position, which isn't real. You know, I even kind of smile when people kind of go, like, how could people have war? Why do people fight? Like, what reality are you in? You know, it's like this has been going on nonstop for all of history. You know, to say people should resolve disputes, you know, by negotiation, well, that takes a lot. You know, it's, I kind of think of, like, how do you negotiate who rules Jerusalem? There's no both sides. You know, there's no middle position on that the two sides right now have. You know, and you have to be willing, you know, and people, you know, these things are very hard to do. And the judge, in all our judgments, which fall harshly on ourselves and others come out of losing touch with our empathy and our compassion and our intention. Instead of our intention is, this is the way I want the world to be, rather than looking at it and realizing this is the way the world, this is kind of normal reality. You know, this is the way people are. You know, when you make a mistake, look around. It's not, wow, is it an unusual thing? It's like, I remember somebody getting most upset when I criticized them. And it was like, what I said about you is a common fault. Why are you so, would you get so upset with everyone who, you know, has that problem? And it's, you know, it's not a big deal. You know, have compassion for yourself rather than thinking, it's so awful, how could I be this way? When, look around, it's all around you that we're, you know, wow, I'm selfish. Wow, I'm proud. Wow, I'm opinionated. Wow, I'm envious, jealous, greedy, self-centered. These are all the mind that doesn't want to accept that. You know, have the right intention. It's not really what you want to be. It's not really the way others want to be if you get in touch. It's why often we have a conflict with somebody and then we can find harmony because neither of you, the real intention of in most relationships is frequently to get along and to find harmony. And that's why at times you can go from anger to intimacy quite quickly because you realize neither of you want to be, that's not the real intention. Wow, I just want to be upset with you. I just want to think, hold on. And we can do that with people, but it usually helps if we don't have to have much intimacy with them. I mean, it's easy just to stay critical of somebody who remains remote. It's even why people could just stay in a steady state of anger with George Bush because, of course, they have no contact with him. You know, he's just a concept in their head so they can hold on the ideological position of awfulness over there. Well, if he was around all the time and you were working with him, you know, all it would be a lot harder to say, wow, he's just this. Instead, you know, you'd probably have empathy and compassion for the fellow. Anyway, any comments as I'm talking on?
Your story of having your mom push your buttons reminds me, someone said that Reverend Master Jiu was talking with a group of monks and some had just come back from their family visits and they were talking about that very thing. And she said, well, don't be surprised if your buttons are pushed, because that's where their buttons were made.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's very deep, you know, deep-seated patterns. I mean, we develop pattern. You kind of have that, just think of the irrationality of what annoys you about your parents. And a lot of times it's, you know, it's just like it was conditioned in that drives me crazy. And you look back, what was the big deal, but you know, about it, but we all are. It's, in fact, part of the reason, and part of growing up, and it actually takes a long time to do this, is actually to see your parents as people, rather than the way we usually see them, which is through the thick filter of what we wanted in our parents and what we didn't want in our parents, where we can just spend our life being upset with them without ever actually seeing them for them, and just seeing it through, you know, your filter of what you really want them to be.
I'm really surprised at how often when I'm annoyed with someone, I'm kind of convinced I know what's going through their head and why they're acting a certain way. And so I just get it in my mind. This person's being this way. They're always this way towards me. It's not based on anything.
Oh, yeah. I remember somebody very nicely actually thinking that he really... somebody said something... at a class, and somebody else said something that he thought was would have been was really opinionated and critical of what the other person said, and he was just feeling awful about it. And then and he kind of tells me, "Oh, that person is so upset with me. How do you know? I called him up, and he was really brusque." And I said, "I heard what happened, and I kind of thought, I knew the person. The person really usually doesn't." Is one of those people who nothing bothers, you know, is one of those people who very little, few things really bother him. So I said, you really discuss it with him instead of assuming. It ends up when he spoke to him before, he was really brusque. He was, had woke him up, he had been asleep, you know. And it's just kind of like you often are when you wake up, you know, you're not, your mind's a little, you know, and you're a little brusque and. And the fellow hadn't even noticed the comment, you know. It like had while the other one was so convinced that he had hurt the feelings and that the fellow was upset with him, and you know, well, you know, there was nothing at all. The fellow said, "No, I couldn't care." You know, as I kind of thought, he didn't even notice. You know, and that's, a lot of things are from, we're often coming from an, from a hard opinionated place of what should and should exist, how things should be. And then when they're not that way, it becomes unacceptable and it's my fault and there's something wrong with me. And, you know, and then we even want to hide. You know, and that's often underlies a lot of the fact that people actually put up a fair amount of effort putting up a face to the world of how, you know, what they want to present, because they actually often have a feeling like, if people actually knew how I was, there'd be a problem. In fact, somebody, I remember it was a long time ago, but somebody kind of who got to know me kind of said to me, "You're just like you seem to be." And I'm trying to think. And I'm kind of, for a moment. And I finally realized, I guess that's a compliment. Because they thought I was kind of presenting a nice image and that they would get to know me and find out that I was really this dark, sordid being. And I just kind of smiled. I thought, you know, just like somebody came the other day to meditation instruction, and very nice, I guess, and we smile. They say, "Wow, you sound just like you do on your tapes." I had to think, wait, what am I saying? What would I sound like? You know, and it's part of training to recognize both good and bad exist, that we are both have selfish, really unpleasant tendencies, and we have good tendencies. You know, there's good and bad in us, in others, you know, in our dogs and cats and everything. There's good and bad. And actually it's hard to handle this. This is a difficult aspect, the fact that you have to deal. We want things good. We want things simple. Just like we're often surprised when somebody good can do something bad. You know, it's like, how did they do that? You know, and it's almost like our image of training, as people often describe it, is almost like, I want to feel a form, this perfect self with no weaknesses. I mean, when they really describe what they want to do, this is what they want to do, is they just want to not be, they want to be perfect. You know, and isn't that a good thing to be? In fact, somebody was telling me that, I remember, that I don't want, isn't it good not to want any defilements? say, put the effort in how to deal with the defilements, the goal, you know, because, you know, if you look, you know, it's like the saying from Kazan, most rooms can use a thorough cleaning. Even a million cleanings won't clear away the dust completely. And no matter who, you know, just like whoever I'm with, they have blind spots. They have some things they could do better, but, you know, they just, you know, they're not perfect. You know, there's things that you need to deal with. And training is trying to see ourselves with clarity and empathy. You need both. What's really going on? And empathy for it. So it's not a problem. How can I embrace, you know, just like you're with somebody else. If they're a problem, that's not good. Instead, can I see it with empathy, compassion? And we can trust, and we have to, in training, keep our intention clear. What are we trying to do? You know, it's why we take the refuges, why we train, why we face a wall. We're trying to get in touch with that intention so that we really can start to trust that we want to choose goodness and that we will work at doing this. And yes, we will be overwhelmed by karma at times. You know, that's the nature of it. It's like, I put anybody in a difficult enough situation, you know, for whoever they are, there's a way you can probably overwhelm them. I remember Reverend Master Jiyu just being surprised by something that came up, and she said, I'm surprised and I'm having such a hard time with this. You know, mentally I didn't think this would be that hard, and suddenly when it happened, she felt like it brought up so much karma. She felt like, this is really difficult. I'm having trouble dealing with this, you know, I'm being overwhelmed by it at times, you know, because it was hard, you know, very hard karma for her. Because a lot of training isn't being perfect, but seeing the good and bad and choosing the good. You know, realizing we have a choice and we can actually choose the good thing. And when we don't, we still wanted to choose the good thing. And we have to try to understand better with clarity and compassion. What made us not make that good choice? Where did this mess come from? You know, just like who's doing some almost had a minor bash with the car the other day, and I realized I'm not paying enough attention to something. You know, when I was, you know, that I was concentrating too hard on something and not paying enough attention, you know, almost like, and, you know, and I realized I've done this before, and I better be careful, you know, put my attention into what really needs to be, where it needs to go. And when you make a mistake, it's very important to see look at your intention. Where did this mistake come from? How can you see it with empathy? Because a critical way of looking at it is like, you know, people will almost say, you know, like, you can take the three refuges and criticize yourself with it. It's like, the Sangha is something I'm not worthy to be part of because I'm such a mess. I can't really follow the Dharma. You know, I mean, there is the Buddha, but what does it have to do with me? And you can use the Dharma as almost something, you know, just like, you know, they do in Christianity as a way of beating yourself up for being unworthy. You know, it's like there's a nice Hasidic thing where the greatest sin you can do is forget that you're the son of a king. You know, forget your own true heart. You know, because, you know, you kind of think there's something wrong You know, and it's even why, you know, in the, we're doing the most excellent Mira Savani, it goes, you know, the master says to the monk, you know, just picture yourself with, you know, the great robes and everything on yourself. You know, you're a great master too. Don't lose sight of, you know, you have the same heart, the same mind. You know, don't doubt that. Just realize it's just some karma coming up. And that's why, in a way, we have to convert that nagging voice that's demanding, critical. Not that we don't want to see, but we have to see, how can I see with compassion? Rather than see just like, wow, almost like it's profound. I can see something wrong, like, duh. What? You know, it's like, that's not very profound. And there's always something wrong if you look, you know, just like if you're with somebody, just like whoever somebody trains with, if they look, they're always going to see things wrong. You know, it's like somebody was, got a sore note, somebody wrote me a note kind of complaining about somebody and saying, oh, I just couldn't take this, how he made this mistake. And I thought, everybody makes that mistake. You know, somebody kind of being, you know, insensitive. And I thought, God, there's not a single person you'll ever find who is not going to make that mistake. Yes, it was a mistake, because I was around when the person did it, but it's not a big deal. It's normal stuff, because it was even a mistake with me. The person was critical of me, but I thought, it's no big deal. No, it's like, duh, have I been critical of them unfairly? Yes. Don't we all do that? Have this kind of self-righteous, critical, knee-jerk reaction where we get quick judgment. And we all fall into that. And what we're trying to do is convert that.
Henry?
Yeah.
Can you actually convert what comes up? In other words, I sort of was understanding that we don't really have control about what comes up, but what we can work on is the reaction. And then maybe what comes up will be either less or more or whatever, but we don't really control what comes up, do we?
We don't control what comes up, but we control, as you're saying, our reaction to it, which either allows it to arise and pass or stay. So you can keep the critical mind that comes up, or you can actually see it, counteract it with the right mind, you know, with the non-critical mind, you know, and develop the habit and the pattern of doing that. And that both reduces, you know, we either strengthen or weaken all the karma in how we respond to it. We cultivate certain karma, like, hell, I grew up cultivating a critical mind. I mean, I really put a lot, I'm not kidding, I put a lot of energy into being critical and actually thinking it's good how critical I am of me. I thought that was a virtue, so not only did I not weaken it, I strengthened it as much as I could, thinking, wow, there's no way no way too much pride's going to get in here. I'll keep myself. But you let it burn, in a way it's like burning out, it's like a flame. You can think of the defilements as a flame, the critical mind, and we either feed it fuel or we take fuel away. And the waters of compassion is taking the fuel away from all the defilements. Or we can feed them, same way as you can feed greed. If I every day go out to a nice bakery and have an elaborate, wow, I can make it almost like I'm built in. This is what life is. And cultivate the greed. Or you can have it where if you stop doing it, you don't even think about it. I like coffee. But when I've been in a position where I don't drink coffee, after a while I forget about, you know, it doesn't even occur to me that I can remember when I wasn't, I stopped, at the points I've stopped drinking coffee. And after a while it burns away. You know, it's not like, it's built into my DNA. I have to drink, like, you know, I have to drink coffee. So it all can burn out if you do it, and it's how we approach it. So the purification of our heart is cultivating our intention to do good, and that burns out the intention not to do good, which is the arising of seeing things actually in a deluded way. And a lot of the delusion is that critical mind, which if we cultivate, is going to keep feeding us delusion, like harsh judgments that are very harsh. You know, just like the person I'm talking about being critical, was like, our mind was hard and set. You know, it's like, this is wrong. This is completely unacceptable. God, it was normal. Very normal stuff. You know, just the way people are. And that you're never going to go anywhere and not have, she's going to keep hitting that same problem again and again and again because it's normal karma. You know, this is, if you want to be critical, you're going to always find something not right.
So in the very scene of that, that karma, in a way, is converted because you're seeing that there is more. In other words, if you see a person, if you're critical of a person, you're seeing that person, say, as evil. But if you see them, as you say, just like everybody else, and that it's just a blind spot, or it's they woke up, you just woke them up, then suddenly that karma is converted into something much bigger. So that is the conversion.
Yeah, and actually you see them as Buddha. You know, they're the same as whoever you think the most of. You know, they're actually the same as the Dalai Lama. You know, whatever it is that you have a lot of respect for. Just like I used to actually remind people, if ever Master Jiyu did this, what would I... I would just ignore it. Because I knew I actually trained myself quite hard, not always successfully, but put a lot of effort in not getting caught up in her, in whatever was, you know, whatever she did that bothered me or I was critical of, because, you know, it's not very helpful. You know, it's not going to help my master-disciple relationship. To think, God, why is she doing this? But I then had to realize I can do that with everyone else. You know, why am I, there's no real difference. It's just, I'm doing it with her, and it's, you know, and I even heard people make the mistake of kind of saying, well, they're never going to have to do a lot of these things with anyone else, you know, like master disciple. And I thought, no, you have to do it with every, you know, it actually doesn't fundamentally change. In the end, you still have to bring that same mind and that same willingness to let go of things and to whatever you encounter. And everything is the Buddha, so it's not just like, it's not as clean as I want it to be. We both have to see that there's dirt and there's purity. And both are true. It's like walking into the room. There's nothing really unclean, even though it needs a cleaning. You know, it's just, I choose not to want dirt here. It's a choice. It's not, it doesn't mar reality to have dirt. Just like it doesn't mar reality, the fact that the person is selfish. It would be, you know, my cat's selfish, I like her. Mm-hmm. It's mostly because I don't think, wow, Moochie, why are you so why are you so self-centered? All you want me to do is pet you. It's like, why are you getting caught up in that? What are you giving me, Moochie? Because I kind of know it's Moochie, you know, it's a cat. I don't know what the cat views me. I have not a clue what she sees when she sees this big being 10 times her size who picks her up when she doesn't want to be picked up and just doesn't provide good service.
Dumb human.
Yeah. Just keep not being. In fact, she's locked up right now. I meant to let her out. I locked her up because I left the door of the hall open. And I think she was going to go in there. So I locked her in the bedroom just so she wouldn't go in the hall during the meditation period. But I meant to let her out during the class. And I'm just not a good servant. And I have painful memories of actually having Jet be in a room for like a day before I looked for her. So because Jed, I didn't even, in that case, I didn't lock her in, but I forgot to look for her for a day, and Jed was locked in a bedroom, and I opened the door, and she burst out. Like, you know, just kind of popped right through the door. And then Merge Cat wouldn't say anything, so I didn't. She was right next to my room, but she never would think, you know, it wasn't in her brain that maybe if you made noise, you would attract attention. So she was always getting locked into rooms because I'd walk into a room, she'd follow me. I didn't see her walk out the room, close the door, and there would be Jet. So I had to regularly go around, and if I didn't see Jet for a while, go around and see, are you locked in the garage, the office, the laundry room? You know, you could be locked anywhere.
She had a way of yelling at you. You could tell she was angry. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny how some were like that. I mean, we have two cats now, and one is like that. You let her out in the evening, and if you forget to let her back in, she'll sit by the front door for hours, you know, waiting for somebody to open the door. And then the other one, whatever they want, they'll let you know.
Oh, yeah.
Meow real loudly.
And I'm very grateful that, I was always grateful that Jet didn't meow. And actually, Moochie, as loud as she can be, at times doesn't do it unless she sees you. So, like, she's not, you won't hear her, she's locked in the room, she won't say anything. But, you know, because she doesn't register that might get my attention. And I'm grateful because I don't want to have it like, which I've had with cats, which, again, wakes my willingness. I usually have some difficulty sleeping. And to be woken up in the middle of the night by a cat who wants attention at 3 in the morning is one of those things I have non-Buddhist thoughts about. I remember that kind of lying in bed thinking, now why does a cat need vocal cords?
That's enough. You know,
un-Buddhist thought, but still, I was kind of lying there thinking, it'd be a much better world if she was a quieter cat. And, anyway, and I'll just cover this a little bit more. And there's an image, actually, somebody, I quote from this monk Ajahn Saxita, where he put it down very nicely, where he says, we dwell in a realm that is a place of difficulty, separations, painful experience, brutalities, an inability to really hold on to something satisfying in a lasting way. So we're all really swimming around in a sea of unsatisfactoriness in dukkha. And that's an image I like of life. You're swimming in the sea of, and it's unsatisfactory because it actually doesn't, you know, we can't kind of fully rest. I can even remember coming into training, I actually thought it'd be nice to get to a place where life gets easy. Okay, not in this realm, you know, where it's like easy in the way I wanted it to be, where I could just, okay, I can sit back, I've done it. I don't have to struggle anymore. While he says, we're swimming in a sea of unsatisfactoriness, and the most important thing to bear in mind is not to ingest and drown in the water. And that's what people often do in life. You know, they get overwhelmed by the karma. You know, it's like they're swallowing salt water, which doesn't work. They're drowning. And you know, to be around somebody suffering, it's like they're drowning. They have these circumstances that they can't stay on top of. I was just reading about somebody's financial problems. And, you know, it was like the fellow just couldn't make the choices he needed. You know, he's talking about all things that got some notice because it was one of the New York Times economic writers was going bankrupt, and it's like, and he took out a mortgage that you know he couldn't afford. You know, and it's like, how do you do that? And you just read the articles, like he refused to make the choices that he needed to make. And not only that, he was going to drown in it. And part of it was his spouse clearly refused to make the choices, and but that's his own karma. You know, you still can't, wow. You know, it was kind of clear what he had to do.
And she was a new spouse.
What?
And she was a new, relatively new spouse. I read her resume.
A new spouse. New spouse.
Yeah.
They were new.
Plus, actually, I saw a thing for the story, which is that it was her third time. This is now going to be her third bankruptcy. So, which he didn't include in the story because he didn't really want to. Because then it becomes more about his wife, which wasn't what he wanted the story to be about. Because the story's supposed to be about him, but actually his wife just sort of is oblivious to karma.
How many times can you do that?
Thank you. There's no limit. I mean, you have to. I think you have to wait like 7 years.
You rarely hear people doing it over and over.
Well, I don't think we usually. I mean, you can't. You don't talk about it, but yeah, you can. I think you can do it every 7 years. Or, you know, you're not you're eligible. I can't remember, but the story I read is something like about every 7 years. You know, you get out of bankruptcy, and then technically. It's hard. It should be hard to get credit enough to go back. You know, that's the trick is, you know.
It's not. I have a friend who did bankruptcy, and within weeks he was getting, you are pre-approved for new credit cards.
Well, that's the idiot credit cards. And luckily, they're slowing all that down. In fact, I even smile. Technically, I have almost no income because I'm a monk and I have very little income officially, you know, really, because, probably like, you know, technically, you know, like $1,000 a year official income. And my credit card, you know, which I've had forever, keeps upping my limits. Finally, you know, I'm at a limit of like $30,000, and because I've had the card forever, and I've naturally been perfect, you know, in everything about it, pretty much. Not perfect. I've occasionally forgotten to pay on time a few times, but close to being perfect, you know, never, it was, I got a notice recently, the bank, you know, my credit card thing, blank, was bought by another bank, and all the rest, and they kind of said, you have too much credit, you only can have $15,000. I'm thinking, don't they notice that that would technically on their records be like 15 years of total income? It still makes no sense, but it doesn't make any difference. You know, I've never actually not paid off. You know, I've never carried a balance ever because one of my futures never going to be better. It's straightforward. If I buy something, I better be able to afford it, or I shouldn't buy it. And part of letting go of the critical mind is realizing the critical mind gets caught up with the self, ourselves and other self. And actually, the self is not a real thing. It's a conditioned view. Just like who we are isn't like whatever you think of who you are. It's just kind of conditioned view of some making something out of this history, these habits, these conditions. And we collect it and it becomes, wow, this is a kinray. And naturally, it's even why it's interesting when somebody else tells me who they are, because it usually isn't that's not who I'm seeing. And even somebody else can, sometimes it can be interesting because part of, you know, being a senior monk is sometimes we even discuss people. You know, people want opinions. I'll even ask opinions, you know, like what's going on with this person or how are they doing or something. And you just see how people can have a completely different view of somebody. And it's just deeply ingrained, this way of collecting ourselves into this opinion, judgment, idea of who we are. And one way of not getting caught up and being overwhelmed by karma is letting go of this hard set. This is who I am. This is what I am. This is who they are. There's always, it's like a tip of an iceberg. You know, and underneath it, it's all grounded in the Buddha. And you know, and so it's a lot of training is just kind of letting go of that hard set feeling of, and just kind of letting, just getting in touch with the fact that there's an intention, and it's a good intention. It's not actually, when you're training, you realize, you know, when you're with people, actually there's a harmony in that intention that is what the Sangha brings together. You know, because then it's actually what brings everything together. Because in the end, the real heart wants to do good and not evil. The real heart wants to be free of suffering, wants to free others from suffering. The real heart wants to see reality, which the nice thing about reality, instead of this critical reality, the reality is it's all Buddha. The Buddha can be found in all places, at all times, all situations. Everything is a Buddha. We don't see that. We're getting caught up in it. In an opinion. It may not be clean, but that doesn't make it not Buddha any more than Muchi may be annoying. But she's still the same Buddha as, you know, even if she's screaming at 3 in the morning. You know, she's just being a cat. You're just being human. You know, humans are not that different. In fact, when you're a baby, you scream at 3 in the morning. And everybody accepts it. You're a baby. You get older, you shouldn't be screaming at 3. You know, now you're 18, you should stop doing that. It's time for me to stop. Okay, now so you can all be here.